and could see that they had arrived in the midst of everyone's merriment and fun, and the room was in great disarray. She stepped on crunching nutshells at every turn. They were scattered all over the floor. Simon sent his servants off to do chores, and the room was emptied of people, neighbors and their attendants, as well as most of the children and dogs. While he asked questions and listened to her replies, Simon fastened his shirt and tunic, which were open wide, revealing his bare, hairy chest. The children had brought him to such a state, he said apologetically. He was terribly disheveled. His belt was twisted around, his clothes and hands were dirty, his face was covered with soot, and his hair was full of straw and dust. A few minutes later, two serving women came in to take Kristen and Gauta over to Romborg's women's house. A fire had been started in the fireplace, and several maids busily lit the candles, made up the beds, and helped her and the boy into dry clothes, while others set the table with food and drink. A half-grown maiden with silk-wrapped braids brought Kristen a frothy bowl of ale. The girl was Simon's eldest daughter, Arnjord. Then Simon came into the room. He had tidied himself up, and now looked more as Kristen was used to seeing him, handsomely and splendidly dressed. He was leading his little daughter by the hand, and Ivar and Skúla followed. Kristen asked about her sister, and Simon replied that Romborg had accompanied the Sundbu women down to Ringheim. Jostein had come to get his daughter Helga, and then he wanted Danyi and Romborg to come along too. He was such a merry, kind old man, and he had promised to take good care of the three young wives. Romborg might stay there all winter. She was expecting a child around St. Matthew's Day, and Simon had thought he might have to be away from home that winter, so she would be better off with her young kinswomen. No, it made no difference to the housekeeping here at Formo, whether she was home or not, laughed Simon. He had never demanded that young Romborg trouble herself with all that toil. As to Kristen's plans, Simon said at once that he would travel south with her. He had so many kinsmen there, as well as his father's friends and his own from the past, that he hoped to be able to serve her better than he had in Nidaros. And there it would be easier for him to determine whether it would be wise for her to pay a visit to the king himself. He could be ready to travel in 3 or 4 days. They attended Mass together the next day, which was Sunday, and afterwards they visited Sira Eirik at his home at Romangard. The priest was old now. He received Kristen kindly and seemed very saddened by her troubling fate. Then they went over to Jorungard. The buildings looked the same, and the rooms held the same beds, benches, and tables. It was now her property, and it seemed most likely that her sons would grow up here. This was also where she herself would one day lie down and close her eyes. But never had she felt so clearly as at this moment that life in this home had depended on her father and mother. No matter what they had struggled with in private, from them had streamed warmth, help, peace, and security to everyone else who lived there. Uneasy and dejected as she now felt, it made her weary to listen to Simon talk about his own affairs, his manner and his children. She knew she was being unreasonable. He was willing to do all he could to help her. She realized how good it was of him to agree to leave his home during the Christmas season, and to be away from his wife, as things now stood. No doubt he was thinking a great deal about whether he might have a son. He had only the one child with Romborg, even though they had been married 6 years. Kristen couldn't expect that he should take Erland's and her misfortune so much to heart that he would forget all the joy he had from his own life. But it was strange to be there with him. He seemed so happy and warm and secure in his own home. Without thinking, Kristen had assumed that Ulvild Simon's daughter would be like her own little sister, for whom the child had been named, fair and fragile and pure. But Simon's little daughter was round and plump, with cheeks like apples and lips as red as a berry, lively gray eyes that looked like her father's in his youth, and lovely brown curls. Simon had the greatest love for his pretty merry child, and he was proud of her bright chatter. "Even though this girl is so hideous and wicked and naughty," he said, putting his hands around her chest and tumbling her around as he lifted her up into the air. "I think she must be a changeling that the trolls up here in the hills left in the cradle for her mother and me. Such an ugly and loathsome child she is." Then he set her down abruptly and hastily made the sign of the cross over her 3 times, as if he were frightened by his own imprudent words. Arnyard, the daughter born of his maid, was not beautiful, but she looked kind and sensible, and Simon took her with him whenever he could. He was constantly praising her cleverness. Kristen had to look at everything in Arnyard's marriage chest, at all she had spun and woven and stitched as part of her dowry. "When I place the hand of my daughter into the hand of a faithful husband," said Simon as he gazed after the child, "it will be one of the happiest days of my life." To spare expenses, and so that the journey might proceed faster, Kristen was to take along no maids, nor any servant other than Ulf Haldorsson. 2 weeks before Christmas they left Formo, accompanied by Simon Andersen and his 2 young vigorous men. When they arrived in Oslo, Simon learned at once that the king would not be coming to Norway. He would apparently celebrate Christmas in Stockholm. Erland was being held in the castle at Akersnes. The chieftain was away, so for the time being it would be impossible for any of them to see him. But the deputy royal treasurer, Olav Skierning, promised to let Erland know that they had come to town. Olav was quite friendly toward Simon and Kristen, because his brother was married to Romborg Osman's daughter of Skog, which made him distantly related to the daughters of Lavrans. Ketil of Skog came to town and invited them to spend Christmas with him, but Kristen had no wish for noisy feasting as matters now stood for Erland. And then Simon too refused to go, no matter how earnestly she begged him. Simon and Ketil knew each other, but Kristen had only met her uncle's son once since he had grown up. Kristen and Simon had taken lodgings at the same residence where she had once been the guest of his parents, back when the two of them were betrothed, but this time they were staying in a different building. There were 2 beds in the main room. Kristen slept in one of them. Simon and Ulf slept in the other. The servants bedded down in the stable. On Christmas Eve, Kristen wanted to attend midnight mass at Nonnesetter's church. She said it was because the sisters sang so beautifully. All 5 of them decided to go. The night was starry and clear, mild and lovely. It had snowed a little in the evening, so it was quite bright. When the bells began to ring from the churches, people came streaming out of all the houses, and Simon had to give Kristen his hand. Now and then he would cast a sidelong glance at her. She had grown terribly thin in the autumn, but her tall, erect figure seemed to have regained some of its maidenly softness and quiet grace. Her pale face had assumed the expression from her youth of calm and gentleness, which hid a deep, tense wariness. She had taken on an oddly phantom-like resemblance to the young Kristen from that Christmas time so long ago. Simon gripped her hand hard, unaware that he was doing so until she squeezed his fingers in return. He looked up. She smiled and nodded, and he understood that she had interpreted the pressure of his hand as a reminder that she must remain brave, and now she was trying to show him that she would. When the holy days were over, Kristen went out to the convent and asked to be allowed to pay her respects to the abbess and to those sisters who were still living there since she had left. She then spent a little time in the abbess's parlatory. Afterwards, she went into the church. She realized that there was nothing for her to gain inside the walls of the convent. The sisters had received her kindly, but she saw that for them she was merely one of the many young maidens who had spent a year there. If they had heard any talk about her distinguishing herself from the rest of the young daughters in any way, and not for the better, they made no mention of it. But that year at Nonnesetter, which loomed so large in her own life, meant so little in the life of the cloister. Her father had bought for himself and his family a place in the convent's prayers of intercession for their souls. The new abbess, Fru Aelin, and the sisters said that they would pray for her and for her husband's salvation. But Kristen saw that she had no right to force her way in and disturb the nuns with her visits. Their church stood open to her, as it did to everyone. She could stand in the north aisle and listen to the singing of the pure women's voices from the choir. She could look around the familiar room, at the altars and pictures. And when the sisters left the church through the door to the convent courtyard, she could go up and kneel before the gravestone of Abbess Groa Guttorm's daughter and think about the wise, powerful, and dignified mother whose words she had neither understood nor heeded. She had no other rights in this women's residence for Christ's servants. At the end of the holy days, Sir Munan came to see Kristen. He said he had just learned that she was in Oslo. He greeted her heartily, as he did Simon Andresen and Ulf, whom he kept calling his kinsman and dear friend. He thought it would be difficult for them to win permission to see Erlan. He was being kept under tight guard. Munan himself had not succeeded in gaining access to his cousin. But after the knight had ridden off, Ulf said with a laugh that he thought Munan probably hadn't tried very hard. He was so deathly afraid of being mixed up in the case that he hardly dared hear mention of it. Munan had aged greatly. He was quite bald and gaunt, and his skin hung loosely on his large frame. He was living out at Skogheim with one of his unlawful daughters, who was a widow. Munan would have liked to be rid of her because none of his other children, lawful or unlawful, would come near him as long as this half-sister was managing his household. She was a domineering, avaricious, and sharp-tongued woman. But Munan didn't dare ask her to leave. Finally, around New Year's, Olav Skierning obtained permission for Kristen and Simon to see Erlan. It was again Simon's lot to escort the sorrowful wife to these heartbreaking meetings. The guards were much more careful here than they were in Nidaros not to let Erlan speak to anyone without the chieftain's men being present. Erlan was calm as before, but Simon could see that the situation was now beginning to wear him down. He never complained. He said he suffered no privations and was treated as well as was allowed. But he admitted that the cold bothered him a good deal. There was no hearth fire in the room. And there was little he could do to keep himself clean. Although, he jested, if he hadn't had the lice to fight with, the time might have passed much more slowly out there. Kristen, too, was calm. So calm that Simon held his breath with fear, waiting for the day when she would completely fall apart. King Magnus was making his royal tour of Sweden, and there was little prospect that he would return to his homeland anytime soon, or that there would be any change in Erland's situation. On St. Gregor's Day, Kristen and Ulf Haldorsson had been to church at Nonnesetter. On their way home, as they crossed the bridge over the convent creek, she did not take the road to their hostel, which lay near the bishop's citadel. Instead, she turned east toward the lane near St. Clement's Church, and headed along the narrow alleyways between the church and the river. The day was hazy and gray, and a thaw had set in, so their footwear and the hems of their cloaks grew quickly soaked and heavy from the yellow mud near the river. They reached the fields along the riverbank. Once their eyes met. Ulf laughed softly, and a kind of smirk appeared on his lips, but his eyes were sad. Kristen gave him an odd, sickly smile. A moment later, they were standing on the ridge of a hill. The earth had given way out here sometime before, and the farm now lay right below the hill, so close to the dirty yellow slope, covered with tufts of black, dried weeds, that the rank stench from the pigsty, which they were looking down at, rose up toward them. Two fat sows were wallowing around in the dark muck. The riverbank was only a narrow strip here, the gray, murky current of the river, filled with careening ice floes, ran right up to the dilapidated buildings with the faded rooftops. As they stood there, a man and a woman came walking over to the fenced area and looked at the pigs. The man leaned over and scratched one of the sows with the haft of the silver-chased, thin-bladed axe he was using as a staff. It was Munan Bardson himself, and the woman was Brynhild Fluga. He looked up and noticed them. He stood there gaping until Kristin shouted a merry greeting down to him. Sir Munan began to bellow with laughter.
"Come down and have a hot ale in this vile weather," he called.
On their way down to the farmyard fence, Ulf told Kristin that Brynhild Jonsdottir no longer kept an inn or an alehouse. She had been in trouble several times and was finally threatened with flogging. But Munan had come to her rescue and vouched for her. She promised to stop all her unlawful activities. And her sons now held such positions that, for their sake, their mother had to think about improving her reputation. After the death of his wife, Munan Bardson had taken up with Brynhild again and was often over at Flugagard. He met them at the gate.
"All four of us are kinsmen, after a fashion," he chuckled.
He was slightly drunk, but not overly so.
"You're a good woman, Kristin Lavrun's daughter. Pious, but not at all haughty. Brynhild is now an honorable and respectable woman, too. And I was an unmarried man when I produced the two sons we have together. And they're the most splendid of all my children. That's what I've told you every single day in all these years, Brynhild. I'm more fond of Inga and Goodlike than any of my other children."
Brynhild was still beautiful, but her skin was sallow and looked as if it would be clammy to the touch, thought Kristin, the way it does after standing over a pot of grease all day long. But her house was well kept, the food and drink she set on the table were excellent, and the crockery was pleasing and clean.
"Yes, I drop by over here whenever I have business in Oslo," said Munan. "A mother likes to hear news of her sons, you see. Inga writes to me himself, because he's a learned man, Inga. A bishop's envoy has to be, you know. I found him a good match, too. Tora Bjarne's daughter from Grota. Do you think many men could have acquired such a woman for their bastard son? So we sit here and talk about that, and Brynhild brings in the food and ale for me, just like in the old days, when she wore my keys at Skogheim. It's hard to sit out there now and think about my blessed wife. So I ride over here to find some solace, when Brynhild here has a mind to grant me a little kindness and warmth."
Ulf Haldarsson was sitting with his chin in his hand and gazing at the mistress of Husaby. Kristin sat and listened, answering quietly and gently and courteously, just as calm and refined as if she were a guest at one of the grand estates back home in Trøndelag.
"Well, Kristin Lavrun's daughter, you won honor and the name of wife," said Brynhild Fluga, "even though you came willingly enough to meet Erland up in my loft. But I was called a wanton and loose woman all my days. My stepmother sold me into the hands of that man there. I bit and fought, and the scratches from my fingernails marked his face before he had his way with me."
"Are you going to bring that up again?" fretted Munan. "You know full well. I've told you so many times before, I would have let you go in peace if you had behaved properly and begged me to spare you. But you rushed at my face like a wildcat before I had even stepped inside the door."
Ulf Haldarsson chuckled to himself.
"And I've treated you well ever since," said Munan. "I gave you everything you wanted. And our children. Well, they're in a better and more secure position than those poor sons of Kristin. May God protect the poor boys, the way Erland has left things for his children. I think that must be more important to a mother's heart than the name of wife, and you know how many times I wish that you had been high-born so that I might marry you. I've never liked any other woman as much as you, even though you were seldom gentle or kind to me. And the wife I did have, may God reward her. I've established an altar for my Katrin and me in our church, Kristin. I've thanked God and Our Lady every day for my marriage. No man has had things better."
He sniffed and began to cry. A little later, Ulf Haldarsson said they would have to leave. He and Kristin didn't exchange a single word on the way home. But outside the main door, she took Ulf's hand.
"Ulf, my kinsman and my friend."
"If it would help," he said quietly. "I would gladly go to the gallows in Erland's place.
for his sake and for yours.
In the evening, a little before bedtime, Kristen was sitting alone in the room with Simon. Suddenly, she began to tell him where she had been that day. She recounted the conversation they had had out there. Simon was sitting on a small stool a short distance away, bending forward slightly, with his arms resting on his thighs and his hands hanging down. He sat and gazed up at her with a peculiar searching look in his small, sharp eyes. He didn't say a word, and not a muscle twitched in his heavy, broad face. Then Kristen mentioned that she had told her father everything, and what his response had been. Simon sat in the same position without moving, but after a while he said calmly, "That was the only request I have ever made of you in all the years we've known each other. If I remember right, that you should... But if you couldn't keep that to yourself to spare Lavrans, then..." Kristen's body trembled violently.
"Yes, but... Oh, Erlan, Erlan, Erlan!"
At her wild cries, the man leaped to his feet. Kristen had flung herself forward, and with her head in her arms she was rocking from side to side, calling to Erland over and over in between the quavering, racking sobs that seemed to be wrung from her body, filling her mouth with moans that welled up and spilled out. "Kristen, in the name of Jesus." When he grasped her arms and tried to console her, she threw her full weight against his chest and put her arms around his neck as she continued to weep and call out her husband's name. "Kristen, calm yourself." He crushed her in his arms, but saw that she took no notice. She was crying so hard that she couldn't stand on her own. Then he lifted her in his arms, held her tight for a moment, and then carried her over to the bed and laid her down. "Calm yourself," he again implored, his voice stifled and almost threatening. He placed his hands over her face, and she took hold of his wrists and arms and then clung to him.
"Simon, Simon, oh, he must be saved."
"I'll do what I can, Kristen, but now you must calm yourself."
Abruptly, he turned away, walked to the door, and went out. He shouted so loudly that his voice echoed between the buildings. He called for the serving maid Kristen had hired in Oslo. She came running, and Simon told her to go in to her mistress. A moment later, the girl came back out. Her mistress wanted to be left alone, she fearfully told Simon. He hadn't moved from the spot where he stood. He nodded and went over to the stable, staying there until his servant Gunnar and Ulf Haldorsson came out to give the horses their evening fodder. Simon began talking with them, and then went with Ulf back to the main house. Kristen saw little of her brother-in-law the following day, but after mid-afternoon prayers, as she sat and sewed on a garment she was going to take to her husband, Simon came dashing into the room. He didn't speak to her or look at her. He merely threw open his traveling chest, filled his silver goblet with wine, and left. Kristen stood up and followed. Outside the main door stood a stranger, still holding the reins of his horse. Simon took a gold ring off his finger, tossed it into the goblet, and drank a toast to the messenger. Kristen guessed what the news was and shouted joyfully, "You've been given a son, Simon!"
"Yes."
He slapped the messenger on the shoulder as the man uttered his thanks and tucked the goblet and ring under his belt. Then Simon put his arm around the waist of his wife's sister and spun her around. He looked so happy that Kristen had to put her hands on his shoulders. Then he kissed her full on the mouth and laughed loudly.
"I see it will be the Dara lineage after all, that will live on at Formo after you're gone, Simon," she said joyously.
"So be it, if God wills."
When Kristen asked him if they should go to Evensong together, he replied,
"No, tonight I want to go alone."
That evening he told Kristen he had heard that Erling Vidkunsen was supposed to be at his manor, Åker, near Tunsberg. Earlier in the day, Simon had booked passage on a ship down the fjord. He wanted to talk to Sir Erling about Erland's case. Kristen said very little. They had mentioned this possibility before, but avoided discussing it further, whether Sir Erling had known about Erland's endeavor or not. Simon said he would seek Erling Vidkinson's counsel, ask him what he thought of Kristen's plan that Simon should accompany her to meet with Lavran's powerful kinsmen in Sweden, to ask the help of friends and kin. Then she said, "But you have received such great news, brother-in-law, that it seems to me it would be more reasonable for you to postpone this journey to Acre, and first travel to Ringheim to see Romborg and your son." He had to turn away, he felt so weak. He had been waiting for this. Whether Kristen would show some sign that she understood how he longed to see his son. But when he had regained mastery of his feelings, he said with some embarrassment, "I've been thinking, Kristen, that God will perhaps grant the boy better health if I can be patient and rein in my longing to see him until I've helped Erland and you a little more in this matter." The next day, Simon went out and bought rich and splendid gifts for his wife and son, as well as for all the women who had been at Romborg's side when she gave birth. Kristen took out a beautiful silver spoon she had inherited from her mother. This was for the infant, Andre Simonsen. But to her sister she sent the heavy gilded silver chain, which Lavrans had once given her in her childhood, along with the reliquary cross. The cross she now moved to the chain Erland had given her as a betrothal present. The following day, around noon, Simon set sail. In the evening, the ship anchored off an island in the fjord. Simon stayed on board, lying in a sleeping bag made of pelts, with several homespun blankets spread on top. He looked up at the starry skies, where the images seemed to rock and sway as the ship pitched on the sleepily gliding swells. The water sloshed and the ice floes scraped and hammered against the sides of the vessel. It was almost pleasant to feel the cold seeping deeper and deeper into his body. It was soothing. And yet he was now certain that as bad as things had been, they would never be so again, now that he had a son. It was not that he thought he would love the boy more than he did his daughters, but this was different. As joyful as the small maidens could make him feel whenever they came to their father with their games and laughter and chatter, and as wonderful as it felt to have them sitting on his lap with their soft hair beneath his chin, a man could not claim the same position in the succession of men among his kin if his estate and property and the memory of his deeds in this world should be transferred on the hand of his daughter to some other lineage. But now that he dared to hope, if only God would allow this infant boy to grow up, that son would follow father at Formo. Andres Gudmundsson, Simon Andersen, Andres Simonsen. Then it was clear that he must be for Andres what his own father had been for him, a man of integrity, both in his secret thoughts and in his actions. Sometimes he felt he didn't have the strength to continue. If only he had seen a single sign that she understood. But Kristen behaved toward him as if they were actual siblings, considerate of his welfare, kind and loving and gentle. And he didn't know how long it could last, living together in the same house in this manner. Didn't she ever think about the fact that he couldn't forget? Even though he was now married to her sister, he could still never forget that they had once been betrothed to live together as man and wife. But now he had a son. Whenever he said his prayers, he had always shied away from adding any of his own words, whether wishes or words of gratitude. But Christ and Mary knew full well what he meant when he had said double the number of Pater Nosters and Ave Marias lately. He would continue to do so as long as he was away from home. And he would show his gratitude in an equally fitting and generous manner. Then perhaps he would receive help on this journey as well. In truth, he thought it unreasonable to expect to make any gains from this meeting. Relations between Erling and the king were now quite cold. And no matter how powerful and proud the former regent might be, no matter how little he needed to fear the young king, who was in a much more difficult position than Norway's wealthiest and most high-born man, It was still unlikely that he would want to provoke King Magnus even more by speaking on Erland Nikolausen's behalf and drawing suspicion upon himself that he might have known about Erland's treasonous plans. Even if Erling had taken part in them, yes, even if he was behind the whole undertaking, prepared to intervene and allow himself to be placed in charge of the realm as soon as there was once again an underaged king in the land, he would not feel bound to take any risks to help the man who would ruin the entire plan for the sake of a shameful love affair. This was something Simon almost forgot whenever he was together with Erland and Kristen, for the two of them seemed hardly to remember it anymore. But it was true that Erland himself was to blame for the whole endeavor, resulting in nothing more than misfortune for him and the good men who had been exposed by his foolish philandering. He must try every recourse to help her and her husband. And now he began to hope. Perhaps God and the Virgin Mary or some of the saints, whom he had always honored with offerings and alms, would support him in this undertaking too. He arrived at Acker quite late the following evening. An overseer on the estate met him and sent servants on ahead, some with the horses, and some to escort Simon's man over to the servants' hall. The overseer himself went up to the loft where the knight was sitting and drinking. A moment later, Sir Erling came out onto the gallery and stood there as Simon climbed the stairs. Then he welcomed his guest courteously enough and led him into the chamber where Stig Håkonsson of Mandvik was sitting with a very young man who was Erling's only son, Bjarne Erlingsson. Simon was received in a friendly fashion. The servants took his outer garments and brought in food and drink. But he could see that the men had guessed why he had come, or at least Erling and Stig had, and he noticed their reticence. When Stig began to talk about how rare it was to see Simon in that part of the country, and how he wasn't exactly wearing down the doorstep of his former kinsman, he hadn't even been farther south than to Diefrin since Hofrid died, then Simon replied, "No, not until this winter." But he had been in Oslo for several months now with his wife's sister, Kristin Lavrans' daughter, who was married to Erland Nikolausen. At that, they all fell silent. Then Sir Erling asked politely about Kristin and about Simon's wife and siblings, and Simon asked about Fru Aelin and Erling's daughters, and Stig's health, and news from Manvik and old neighbors there. Stig Håkonsson was a stout, dark-haired man, a few years older than Simon, the son of Hafrid Erling's daughter's half-brother, Sir Håkon Thoresen, and the nephew of Erland Vidkonsson's wife, Aelin Thores' daughter. He had lost his position as sheriff of Shidu and his command of the castle at Tunsberg 2 winters earlier when he fell out of favor with the king, but otherwise he lived well enough at Manvik, although he was a widower with no children. Simon knew him quite well, and had been on good terms with him, as he was with all the kinsmen of his first wife, although the friendship had never been overly warm. He knew what they had all thought about Hofrid's second marriage. Sir Andres Gudmundsson's younger son might be both well-positioned and of good lineage, but he was not an equal marriage match for Hofrid Erling's daughter, and he was 10 years younger than she was. They couldn't understand why she had set her heart on this young man, but they allowed her to do as she wished, since she had suffered so unbearably with her first husband. Simon had met Erling Vidkonsson only a couple of times before, and then he had always been in the company of Fru Aelin, and uttered hardly a sound. No one needed to say more than yes or ah whenever she was in the room. Sir Erling had aged quite a bit since that time. He had grown stouter, but he still had a handsome and stately figure, for he carried himself exceedingly well, and it suited him that his pale, reddish-gold hair had now turned a gleaming silvery gray. Simon had never met the young Bjarne Erlingsson before. He had grown up near Bjørgvin in the house of a clergyman who was Erling's friend. Within the family, it was said that this was because the father didn't want his son living out there at Giske, amidst all the prattling of the women. Erling himself didn't spend any more time at home than he had to, but he didn't dare take the boy along with him on his frequent journeys, because Bjarne had suffered poor health in his childhood, and Erling Vidkunsson had lost two other sons when they were small. The boy looked exceptionally handsome as he sat with the light behind him, and his face turned in profile. Thick, black, curly hair cascaded over his forehead. His big eyes were dark, his nose was large, with a graceful curve. His lips were firm and delicate, his chin well-shaped. He was also tall, broad-shouldered, and slim. But when Simon was about to sit down at the table to eat, the servant moved the candle. And then he saw that the skin of Bjarne's throat was completely eaten away by scrofulous scars. They spread out to both sides, all the way up to his ears and under his chin. Dead, shiny white patches of skin, purplish stripes, and swollen knots. And Bjarne had the habit of suddenly pulling up the hood of the round, fur-trimmed velvet shoulder collar which he wore even inside the house, pulling it up to his ears. After a few minutes it would grow too hot for him, and he would let it fall back, only to pull it up again. He didn't seem aware that he was doing this. After a while, Simon felt his own hands grow restless from watching him, even though he tried to avoid looking in his direction. Sir Erling hardly took his eyes off his son, although he too seemed unaware that he was sitting with his gaze fixed on the boy. Erling Vidkunsson's face showed little emotion, and there was no particular expression in his pale blue eyes, but behind that somewhat vague and watery glance, there seemed to lie endless years of worry and care and love. Then the three older men conversed, politely but in a desultory fashion, while Simon ate, and the young man sat there fidgeting with his hood. Afterwards, all four of them drank for a proper length of time, and then Sir Erling asked Simon if he was weary from his journey, and Stig invited him to share his bed. Simon was glad to postpone talking about the purpose of his visit. This first evening at Aker had left him quite dejected. The next day, when he finally spoke of it, Sir Erling replied in much the way Simon had expected. He said that King Magnus had never willingly listened to him, but he had noticed that the moment Magnus Eiriksson became old enough to have an opinion, it had been his view that Erling Vidkunsson wouldn't have anything more to say to him after he came of age. And ever since the dispute had been settled between Erling and his friends on one side and the king on the other, he had neither heard from nor spoken to the king or the king's friends. If he spoke on Erland's behalf to King Magnus, it would be of little benefit to the man. And he was aware that many people in the country thought he had been behind Erland's undertaking in some way. Simon could believe him or not, but neither he nor his friends had known anything about what was being planned. But if this matter had come to light in a different fashion, or if these adventuresome young daredevils had carried through their plot and failed, then he might have stepped forward and tried to mediate. But because of the way things had gone, he didn't think anyone could reasonably demand him to stand up and reinforce the people's suspicions that he had been playing two games. But he advised Simon to appeal to the Hoftersons. They were the king's cousins. And when they weren't quarreling with him, they managed to maintain a certain friendship. And as far as Erling could see, the men Erland was protecting were more likely to be found among the Hoftersons' circles, as well as among the younger noblemen. As everyone knew, the king's wedding was to be celebrated in Norway that summer. It might provide a fitting opportunity for King Magnus to show mercy and leniency toward his enemies. And the king's mother and Lady Isabel would no doubt attend the festivities. Simon's mother had been Queen Isabel's handmaiden when she was young, after all. Perhaps Simon should appeal to her. Or perhaps Erland's wife ought to fall to her knees before the king's bride and Lady Ingebjörg Håkon's daughter with her prayers for their intercession. Simon thought it would have to be the last resort, for Kristin to kneel before Lady Ingebjörg. If she had realized what was honorable, Lady Ingebjörg would have long ago stepped forward to gain Erland's release from his troubles. But when Simon had once mentioned this to Erland, he had simply laughed and said that Lady Ingebjörg always had so many troubles and worries of her own, and no doubt she was angry because it now seemed unlikely that her most beloved child would ever win the title of king. Chapter 7. In early spring, Simon Andersen traveled north to Toten to see his wife and infant son and accompany them home to Formo. He stayed there for some time to tend to his own affairs. Kristin didn't want to leave Oslo, and she didn't dare give in to her burning, urgent longing to see her three sons who were back home in Gudbrandsdal. If she was going to continue to endure the life she was now living from day to day, she couldn't think about her children. And she did manage to endure. She seemed calm and brave. She talked and listened to strangers and accepted advice and encouragement. But she had to hold on to the thought of Erlan. Only Erlan. In those moments when she failed to hold her thoughts tight in the grasp of her will, other images and pictures would race through her mind. Ivar standing in the woodshed at Formo with Simon, and waiting expectantly as his uncle searched for a split piece of wood for him, bending down to heft each one in his hand. Gauta's fair, boyish face, full of manly determination as he struggled through the snowdrifts on that gray, wintry day in the mountains last fall. His skis slipped backwards, and he slid some distance down the steep slope, sinking deep into the snow. For a moment, his face seemed about to crumple. He was an exhausted, helpless child. Her thoughts would wander to her youngest sons. Munan must be able to walk and even talk a little by now. Was he just as sweet as the others had been at his age? Lavrans had probably forgotten her by now. And the two oldest boys out at the monastery at Tautra. Nokva, Nokva. Her firstborn. How much did the two older sons understand? What were they thinking about? And how was Nokva, still a child, coping with the fact that now nothing in his life would be the way that she and he and everyone else had imagined it would be? Sira Eiliv had sent her a letter, and she had reported to Erland what it said about their sons. Otherwise, they never spoke of their children. They didn't talk about the past or the future anymore. Kristin would bring him some piece of clothing or a plate of food. He would ask her how she had fared since they last met, and they would sit on the bed holding hands. Sometimes they would be left alone for a moment in the small, cold and filthy, stench-filled room. Then they would cling to each other with mute, passionate caresses, hearing but paying no attention to Kristen's maid laughing with the castle guards outside on the stairs. There would be plenty of time, either after he was taken from her or after he came back to her, for thinking about all the children and their changed circumstances, and about everything else in her life besides her husband. She didn't want to lose a single hour of the time they had together, and she didn't dare think about her reunion with the four sons she had left behind up north. For this reason, she accepted Simon Andersen's offer to travel alone to Nidaros. Along with Arne Javeltsen, he would see to her interests in the settling of the estate. King Magnus would not be made richer by acquiring Erland's property. His debts were much greater than he himself had thought, and he had raised money that was sent to Denmark and Scotland and England. Erland shrugged his shoulders and said with a faint smile that he didn't expect to be compensated for that. So Erland's situation was largely unchanged when Simon Andersen returned to Oslo around Holy Cross Day in the fall. But he was horrified to see how exhausted they both looked, Kristin and his brother-in-law, and he felt strangely weak and sick at heart when they both still had enough composure to thank him for coming at that time of year, when he could least be spared from his own estates. But now people were gathering in Tunsberg, where King Magnus had come to wait for his bride. A little later in the month, Simon managed to book himself passage on a ship with several merchants who were planning to sail there in a week's time. One morning a stranger arrived with a request that Simon Andersen should trouble himself to come to St. Halvard's Church at once. Olav Schierning was waiting for him there, The deputy royal treasurer was in a terribly agitated state. He was in charge of the castle while the treasurer was in Tunsberg. The previous evening, a group of gentlemen had arrived and shown him a letter with King Magnus's seal on it, saying that they were to investigate Erland Nikolausen's case. He had ordered the prisoner to be brought to them. The three men were foreigners, apparently Frenchmen. Olav didn't understand their language, but this morning the royal priest had spoken to them in Latin. They were supposedly kinsmen of the maiden who was to be Norway's queen. What a promising start this was. They had interrogated Erland in the harshest manner, had brought along some kind of rack and several men who knew how to use such things. Today, Olav had refused to allow Erland to be taken out of his chamber and had put him under heavy guard. He would take responsibility for it, because this was not lawful. Such conduct had never been heard of before in Norway. Simon borrowed a horse from one of the priests at the church and rode at once back to Akersnes with Olav. Olav Skierning glanced a little anxiously at the other man's grim face, which was flooded with furious waves of crimson. Now and then Simon would make a wild and violent gesture, not even aware of it himself. But the borrowed horse would start, rear up, and rebel beneath the rider.
"I can see you're angry, Simon," said Olav Skierning.
Simon hardly knew what was foremost in his mind. He was so furious that he felt spells of nausea overtake him, the blind and desperate feeling that surged up inside him, driving him to the utmost rage, was a form of shame. A man who was defenseless, without weapon or protection, who had to tolerate the hands of strangers in his clothes, strangers searching his body. It was like hearing about the rape of women. He grew dizzy with the desire for revenge and the need to spill blood to retaliate. No, such had never been the custom in Norway. Did they want Norwegian noblemen to grow used to tolerating such things? That would never happen. He was sick with horror at what he would now see. Fear of the shame he would bring upon the other man by seeing him in such a state overwhelmed all other feelings as Olav Skierning unlocked the door to Erland's prison cell. Erland was lying flat on the floor, his body placed diagonally from one corner of the room to the other. He was so tall that this was the only way he could find enough room to stretch out full length. Some straw and pieces of clothing had been placed underneath him, on top of the floor's thick layer of filth. His body was covered all the way up to his chin with his dark blue fur-lined cape, so that the soft grayish-brown marten fur of the collar seemed to blend with the curly black tangle of the beard that Erland had grown while in prison. His lips were pale next to his beard. His face was snowy white. The large, straight triangle of his nose seemed to protrude much too far from his hollowed cheeks. His gray flecked hair lay in lank, sweaty strings, swept back from his high, narrow forehead. At each temple was a large purple mark, as if something had clamped or held him there. Slowly, with great difficulty, Erland opened his big, pale blue eyes and attempted to smile when he recognized the men. His voice was odd-sounding and husky.
"Sit down, brother-in-law."
He turned his head toward the empty bed.
"I've learned a few new things since we last met."
Olav Skierning bent over Erland and asked him if he wanted anything. When he received no answer, probably because Erland had no strength to reply, he pulled the cape aside. Erland was wearing only linen pants and a ragged shirt. The sight of the swollen and discolored limbs shocked and enraged Simon like some indecent horror. He wondered whether Erland felt the same way. A shadow of a blush passed over his face as Olav gently rubbed his arms and legs with a cloth he had dipped in a basin of water. And when he replaced the cape, Erland straightened it out with a few small movements of his limbs, and by drawing it all the way up to his chin, so that he was completely covered.
"Well," said Erland.
Now he sounded a bit more like himself, and the smile was stronger on his pale lips.
"Next time, it will be worse.
but I'm not afraid. No one needs to be afraid. They won't get anything out of me. Not that way.
Simon could tell that he was speaking the truth. Torture was not going to force a word out of Erland Nikolaussen. He could do and say anything in anger and on impulse, but he would never let himself be budged even a hand's breadth by violence. Simon realized that the shame and indignation he felt on the other man's behalf was not something Erland felt himself. Instead, he was filled with a stubborn joy at defying his tormentor and a confident faith in his ability to resist. He, who had always yielded so pitifully when confronted by a strong will, who might have shown cruelty himself in a moment of fear, now displayed his valor when he, in this cruel situation, sensed an opponent who was weaker than he was. But Simon snarled through clenched teeth.
"Next time. We'll never come. What do you say, Olav?"
Olav shook his head, but Erland said with a trace of the old impudent boldness in his voice,
"If only I could believe that. As firmly as you do. But these men will hardly be satisfied with this."
He noticed the twitching of Simon's muscular, heavy face.
"No, Simon. Brother-in-law."
Erland tried to raise himself up on one elbow. In pain, he uttered a stifled moan and then sank back in a faint. Olav and Simon tended to him. When the fainting spell had passed, Erland lay still with his eyes open wide. He spoke more somberly.
"Don't you see? How much is at stake for King Magnus? To find out which men he shouldn't trust, farther than he can see them. So much unrest and discontent as we've had here. Well, if he thinks this will quell the discontent, then,"
said Olav Skirning angrily. But Erland said in a soft, clear voice,
"I've handled this matter in such a way that few will consider it important how I'm treated. I know that myself."
The two men blushed. Simon hadn't thought that Erland understood this, and neither of them had ever referred to Fru Suniva. Now he exclaimed in despair,
"How could you be so foolish and reckless?" "I can't understand it either, now," said Erland honestly. "But how in hell was I to know that she could read? She seemed so uneducated."
His eyes closed again. He was about to faint once more. Olav Skirning murmured that he would get something and left the room. Simon bent over Erland, who was again lying there with half-open eyes.
"Brother-in-law, did Erling Vidkunsson support you in this matter?"
Erland shook his head and smiled.
"No, by Jesus. We thought either he wouldn't have the courage to join us, or else he would want to control the whole thing. But don't ask me, Simon. I don't want to tell anyone. Then I know that I won't talk."
Suddenly Erland whispered his wife's name. Simon bent over him. He expected Erland to ask him to bring Kristen to him. But he said hastily, as if in a feverish breath,
"She mustn't find out about this, Simon. Tell her the king has sent word that no one is to be allowed to see me. Take her out to Munan, at Skogheim. Do you hear me? These Frenchmen, or Moors, new friends of our king, they won't stop yet. Get her out of Oslo before the news spreads through town. Simon?"
"Yes," he replied, although he had no idea how he would manage it. Erland lay still for a moment with his eyes closed. Then he said with a sort of smile,
"I was thinking last night about the time she gave birth to our eldest son. She was no better off than I am now, judging by how she wailed. And if she could bear it 7 times, for the sake of our pleasure, then surely I can too."
Simon was silent. The involuntary qualms he felt about life revealing to him its last secrets of suffering and desire seemed not to trouble Erland in the least. He wrestled with the worst and with the sweetest,
as innocently as a naive young boy whose friends have taken him to a house of sin, drunken and full of curiosity. Erland rolled his head back and forth impatiently.
These flies are the worst. I think they're the devil himself.
Simon took off his cap and swatted vigorously at the swarms of blue-black flies so that they rose up in great clouds, buzzing noisily. And all those that were knocked senseless to the floor, he furiously trampled in the dirt. It wouldn't help much because the window hole in the wall stood wide open. The previous winter there had been a wooden shutter with a skin-covered opening, but it had made the room very dark. He was still busily flailing at the flies when Olav Skirning came back with a priest who was carrying a drinking goblet. The priest put his hand under Erland's head to support him as he drank. Much of the liquid ran down into his beard and along his neck, but he lay as calm and unconcerned as a child when the priest wiped him off with a rag. Simon felt as if his whole body was in ferment. His blood was pulsing hard in his neck beneath his ears, and his heart was pounding in an odd and restless fashion. He stood in the doorway for a moment, staring at the tall body stretched out under the cape. A feverish flush was now passing in waves over Erland's face. He lay there with his eyes half open and glittering, but he gave his brother-in-law a smile. A shadow of his peculiar boyish smile. The following day, as Stig Håkonsson of Manvik was sitting at the breakfast table with his guests, Sir Erling Vidkunsson and his son Bjarne, they heard the hoofbeats of a lone horse out in the courtyard. A moment later the door of the building was flung open and Simon Andersson stepped swiftly toward them. He wiped his face on his sleeve. He was spattered with mud all the way up to his neck after the ride. The three men sitting at the table rose to their feet to greet the new arrival, with small exclamations that were part welcome and part surprise. Simon didn't greet them, but stood there leaning on the hilt of his sword with both hands. He said, "I bring you strange news. They have taken Erland Nikolausson and stretched him on the rack. Some foreigners that the king has sent to interrogate him." The men shouted and then crowded around Simon Andersson. Stig pounded a fist into the palm of his other hand. What did he tell them? At the same time, both he and Bjarne Erlingsson involuntarily turned to face Sir Erling. Simon burst into laughter. He roared and roared. Then he sank down onto the chair that Bjarne Erlingsson pulled out for him, accepted the ale bowl the young man offered him, and drank greedily.
"Why are you laughing?" asked Sir Erling sternly.
"I was laughing at Stig." Simon was leaning slightly forward, with his hands resting on the thighs of his mud-covered breeches. He gave a few more bursts of laughter. "I had thought. All of us here are the sons of great chieftains. I expected you to be so angry that such a thing could be done to one of our peers that your first response would be to ask how this could possibly happen. I can't say that I know exactly what the law is about such matters. Ever since my lord King Håkon died, I've been content with the idea that I owed his successor my service if he should ask for it, both in war and in peace. Otherwise I've lived quietly on my manor. But now I can only think that this case against Erland Nikolausson has been unlawfully handled. His fellow noblemen have passed judgment on him, but I don't know by what right they condemned him to death. Then a reprieve and safe conduct were granted to him until he could meet with his kinsman, King Magnus, to see whether the king might allow Erland to be reconciled with him. But since then the man has been imprisoned in the tower at Acker's castle for nearly a year, and the king has been abroad almost all that time. Letters have been dispatched, but nothing has come of it. And now he sends over these louts, who are neither Norwegian nor the king's retainers, and who attempt to interrogate Erland with conduct that is unheard of toward any Norwegian man with the rights of a royal retainer, while peace reigns in the land, and Erland's kinsmen and peers are gathering in Tunsberg to celebrate the royal wedding. What do you think of all of this, Sir Erling?
I think... Erling sat down on the bench across from him.
I think you have told us clearly and bluntly how this matter now stands, Simondara. As I see it, the king can only do one of three things. He can allow Erlen to appeal the sentence that was handed down in Nidaros, or he can appoint a new court of royal